As you're turning to the book of Ecclesiastes, let me share a couple of things with you. We're grateful to have a young man about the fourth row over here. Hold your hand up, Jason. Jason Dinsberger is going to be helping us in the office from day to day. We're so happy to have him around, kind of filled in the gaps between so much of the good work that our volunteers do from day to day here in the church office. Saw some missionary folks, Fred and Sandy, raise your hands back there. Folks from former mission work in the Middle East, North Africa, so glad to have them visiting with us. So just for a Sunday, they'll be going back home, but glad to know some other people from International Mission Board circles. We're talking about a time for this, a time for that, there in the book of Ecclesiastes. And as I chatted with them, folks, I couldn't help but remember some days in the International Mission Board when we would have our missionary wannabes come together. Do you remember that candidate conference you attended? I was one of those screeners for the mission personnel for about 4 years. And I'll never forget how you can say the wrong thing at the wrong time so easily. We would let the candidates come in groups of 12 or 15 and share a little of their lives with us. We'd get to know them better, have some interviews with them throughout the day. And on one particular occasion, a sweet lady and husband stood up and they bragged about their ministry and their children. Then I guess maybe she had a little nice round tummy. One of my colleagues said, "Well, when is this one due?" But she wasn't pregnant. And oh, how embarrassed my friend was. He just wanted to climb under the table. Have you ever just said the wrong thing at the wrong time or done the wrong thing at the wrong time? Or you thought it was the right thing, but it was turned out to be wrong. When we were in language school in Portugal, some of my friends and I knew about the Catholic traditions. And we wanted to go check out one of the Catholic churches. The wives didn't want to go. They were kind of nervous about the Portuguese language. And we didn't know the language that well. So four of us decided to go check this Catholic church out. And we asked the gentleman at the back door, in the best Portuguese we had at the time, we'd like to just kind of sit in the back and observe. Well, he, Portuguese were real friendly, took us by the arm, dragged us down to about the second row. We sat down. We didn't know what to do. So when they would stand up, we'd stand up. When they sat down, we... And, you know, Catholics do a lot of stuff. They're quite active. I guess maybe to keep them awake. I don't know. But we didn't know what to do, so there's a guy on the front row, and so we decided, when he stands, we stand. When he sits, we sit. And things were going great until about 15 minutes into the service, and he stood up, and we stood up, and everybody laughed. And we looked around, nobody else behind us was standing, so we sat back down, and we didn't know what was going on. After the service, we apologized to the padre, and he said, "That's quite all right, we understand, you're the guest, you don't speak our language." He spoke very well in English. And I said, "Well, what did we do wrong?" He said, "Well, one of the ladies in our parish had a baby, and we asked the new father to stand up." It was that guy on the front row. Now, honestly, it didn't happen just like that, but let me embellish that a little bit. But there are times for things, and there are times not for things. And as we study this chapter, I'm going to divide it into two parts because there's just so much here. I hope you listen fast because I'd like for us to get through the first part today, first couple of parts. But Solomon, whom we have called by the name that is translated from the Hebrew for preacher or teacher, the word is Koheleth. Koheleth, C-O-L-E-T-H, something like that. Really spelled with a Q in the Hebrew. He is the gatherer, the researcher. And so I'll use his name interchangeably with the teacher, the preacher, the gatherer, the searcher, Koheleth. But as Koheleth has been researching, out there looking for all the answers to life, he has come up empty so many times. But as we've studied in chapter 1 and chapter 2, we're starting to see a shift, a swing of equilibrium into another direction. And an opening of the door where we see his focus on God. Perhaps best so far there in the last couple of verses in chapter 2, but really swinging open in chapter 3. Now, let me just get a feel for the room before I get into this message. How many of you really, really believe that God is in charge. Would you raise your hand? You see how many heretics we have here today? Okay, didn't mean to put you on the spot. But is he really in charge? Do you sense that he's in charge when you lose that spouse, that mate? Do you question sometimes if he's in charge? I did when I lost my job a few years ago. Do you struggle sometimes with this idea we call the sovereignty of God when one in your family or close to you has that incapacitating illness? We do. We struggle, and we're human, and we admit that. But Solomon was struggling with these same questions. And so he starts coming back. And just as when you were a kid and you spun around and got all dizzy, it takes a while to get that equilibrium. He's coming back to a balance. And we often use the phrase, God has a wonderful plan for your life. We use it in witnessing to encourage someone to be open to God's plan for their lives. And that is true. But sometimes when that spouse cheats on us, when that baby dies of sudden infant death syndrome, when horrible things happen, when your boss absconds with all the money, you wonder, okay, God, where in the world is this wonderful plan for my life? And that's where Solomon was. But in these verses today, we understand that we can still trust and love him because of his love for us, as we just sang, I could sing of your love. For even after the storm passes, we can stop and sing of his love. I put in your notes there in the way of introduction. God balances all this life and death and sorrow and joy, the things we read just a few moments ago. He balances it out. Why? Well, he lets this pendulum swing in such a way so that we will not think we can easily figure him out. We'll never figure him out. Put that word figure in there, that first F. We won't figure out his workings. And so we will learn to accept by faith. Put that word in that second space, faith, and enjoy what we have. It is a life of faith, is it not? If it were all handed to us and he wrote that plan out for us verbatim every day of the rest of our lives, there would be no faith. And so Solomon, our searcher, has come in from his research, and he's found some things about man and about God. And first, in that Roman numeral 1, I want you to write the word look, look up. He's found something above man, something transcendent, something greater than man in his wisdom. Solomon has come to find some balance in life's experiences, the yin and the yang, the pendulum swing. And he says, look up. God orders time. He orders it. He is in charge of time. He invented time. He started time. And in the book of Revelation, we read that one day all time will end. So God gives us time. And in these 14 poetic statements, and let me emphasize, these are poetry statements. This is not all-encompassing. But in these statements, he's identified so many of the things that take place in the time we call life. And in these events, we may not understand, but someday, in time, we will be understanding them better. They'll be interpreted for us. They'll be making sense for us if we cooperate with the time that we're in and his time for us in the now. So he really speaks to several issues. I've broken them into several little categories. A, the physical realm. These aren't real hard, fast. But he does begin by pairing death and the boundaries of life and birth under the sun, the physical realm. That's God's working. None of us ask to be born. No one plans to die. Well, some do, but that's really still within God's plan of time for our lives. We kind of think abortion and mercy killing gives us a chance to be involved, but that's really not true. As we may look like we're doing something to hasten or shorten or stop life or start death, birth and death are not human accidents. They are part of God's divine appointment for our lives. I love the passage in Psalm 139. I think you'll see a few of these verses on the screen. When David was writing, he said, "For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. When I was woven together in the depths of the earth, your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be." You know, we laid to rest my mother-in-law just last month. She already had her tombstone made. It was made with her husband. And it had that date of birth, the year, and the dash. Do you know God already has the numbers in mind for when yours is going to be finished? He already knows the day, the year, the time. He already has appointed in his plan not only your life, but also your death. This next pair deals with the supply of food, planting, and uprooting. I mean, you try to plant a crop in winter and see what you'll get. There is a getting out of sync or in sync that God says he balances this out as well. And how much we suffer when we try to get in charge of the seasons and the planting and the harvesting, the things of our lives. We want to be in charge of the schedule. But as Solomon says here, there is a appropriate time for everything. Killing and healing, breaking down, building up there in verse 3. Death and life are often the work, they work hand in hand, just as in our bodies in the physical realm. There are thousands of cells that die, but I keep on living. The mind, the brain is such a mystery and such a beautiful creation of God. Think about this. The brain cells do die, but as they're dying, they pass off to the new cells the memories that they were holding. Now, get your brain around that. What a miracle of life. But death and life go hand in hand. As we so personally learned about chemotherapy this past year, we learned that as the chemical goes in, it kills thousands and thousands of good cells as well as thousands of the bad cells, those that are dividing in mitosis. So killing and life go hand in hand, death and life. And God ordains this. God plans this. He blesses the righteous killing, the taking of a life of a criminal taken by a state or a government. There is a death penalty. It's written about in his word. So these are things in God's hand, not just us participating with him, but God is in charge. He is a sovereign God. Then letter B, the searcher moves to the emotional realm. God's in charge of the emotional, thinking, feeling, choosing, interrelationships. There are certain times established, as he says in verse 4, a time for weeping and laughing, for mourning and dancing. No one's going to get out of those hard times. No one's going to be blessed with just the good times. Even his own son didn't get a pass, didn't get to opt out of the bad. Even in the Old Testament, he was prophesied, foretold, as coming to be a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. But thank God there is a time to celebrate. There is a time. I appreciate you laughing at my funny jokes, even when they're not funny. It's good to laugh, but we also have times that we grieve, but we come to that point of stopping grieving, and there are those days of celebration. Art and Bonnie just got back from the Holy Land. Did those Jewish people dance any? Those Jewish people, they love to dance. I don't know where we Baptists, I've had the question asked to me, do Baptists dance? And the answer is, not too well. But as we sang about it a minute ago, I mean, there was a time there that it felt like moving. As long as we don't move our feet, we're okay. There's celebration. Verse 5, there's the scattering of stones and the gathering of stones. And I love the New American translation of this. A time to throw stones and a time to gather stones. In the literal sense, we know in Israel, just they would throw stones at people. in the Middle East. You see that on TV even today. There's a fable that when God created the world, he sent out a certain angel with stones to spread evenly around the world, and this poor angel tripped in Palestine, and so they've got more than their share. And there was a time in their history that when you had an enemy, you would gather stones and put them in his field, and he couldn't plant, he couldn't harvest because of all the stones. There's that figurative sense that we throw stones and we criticize, and we have the right to criticize, positive criticism, building up someone. But at the same time, when they do something well, we need to commend them. And if our enemy fills our fields with stones, don't just gather them up and throw them back at him. Build something with them. There's a time to gather, a time to build up. So use what comes your way and build something out of it. Don't let it be a stone of stumbling, but let it be a stone of stepping to another level. And there can be those deep emotional wounds from stones. And that's where the body of Christ comes in to mend and to build up and to strengthen. Embracing. Verse 5, the letter, second part of that verse. And refraining from embracing. That has to do with our relationship with other people. And again, the people in the Near East, and even where we worked in Europe, a big hug when you got there, a big hug when you left. There was that personal interaction. And there's a time when we need to embrace people. But there is a time when embracing someone, his or her ideals, would be tantamount to agreeing with him and identifying with him or her. And it's time to step away. It's time to refrain from embracing. There are times that we do certain things in the spiritual realm. Letter 3. Koheleth relates several other opposites in letter C. I'm sorry, the spiritual. God's over the spiritual. And we can relate to these as some of the most decisions and commitments are part of our spiritual life. Marriage, there's a time to search for that mate. Friends, there are times to search for new friends. But there are times to give up when certain friendships or even a job or relationships are not right any longer for us and we make a break. He says there also there's a time to keep and a time to throw away. Ladies, here's that permission to throw away that stack of stuff that he's been keeping by the pile on his chair. Here's that biblical permission to have a garage, to clean out the attic, to bless Salvation Army or whomever you would like to. There's the verse right there. But there's also the figurative sense that we've got to take in consideration. There are values and standards that we must never let go of. We must keep. But then there are those things like resentments and bitternesses and grudges that we must throw away, get rid of, be forgiven and forgotten of those things. Again, a Middle Eastern concept, tearing and mending there in verse 7, probably refers to the Jewish person as they went through grief or anxiety or trials. They would take their garment and just rip it to show how grieved they were. And God expects us to go through sorrows and bereavement and grieve over certain things and mourn. But there comes a time when there's mending. You put aside the mourning, the garment of mourning, and you put on, take off that sackcloth of ashes, the Old Testament calls it, and put on a garment of praise and mend and move on after you put life back together. In verse 7, he also says a time to keep silence and a time to speak. And there are times when we know that little piece of gossip. It may not even be gossip. It may be truth, but it's just not right to say it. And then there are other times when we know if we don't say something, if we don't stand up for someone's right, then we're as guilty as they are. We have to take our stand and state a truth and speak up at times. In verse 8, this is an easy one, a time to love. We can all do that. But how about this one, a time to hate? When is it right to hate? I read the story of Abraham Lincoln as he made one of his first trips through New Orleans and he saw a slave on the auction block. His heart was broken. And he decided right then and there, if there was ever an opportunity that he had to do something about slavery, he would. He hated it. And we as Christians, there are certain things, if we are sons and daughters of the Most High God, we will hate and we will fight and we will stand against them. Things that God hates, we should hate. Things that He loves, we should love. And find that balance in our lives. This last phrase, there's a time for war and a time for peace. When tyranny rides roughshod over men, we've got to fight. There would be no U.S. of A. had it not been for some righteous wars, some just wars. But there's a time when war is absolutely wrong. I put this illustration in your notes. Life is a lot like some of those prescriptions that you take. My goodness, if you would take some of those drugs that you pop in your mouth and take them apart and perhaps take them individually as some of the chemicals they are, it would kill you. But if you take them the way the doctor prescribes, they can heal you. So there is a time for healing, a time for breaking down, a time for war, a time for peace. This is God's plan. Don't avoid it. Don't think you deserve a get out of jail free, because God doesn't offer that, because He knows if you did not go through those tough times, you'd be that spoiled brat. You'd be that person that's selfish, cruel, vicious, shallow. So He sends these times, the searcher said, in their own time, in their own season, in their own time. Now, secondly, as Solomon was searching, he not only finds something transcendent, something above, something bigger than us, the God side, but he also sees there's something within us that links us to God. It's that looking within to see that we have eternity in our hearts. I won't read these verses all together, but let me just kind of work through them, verses 9 through 14, one at a time. And here we see Koheleth adjusting his sights, no longer looking at life under the sun, but God has given him a new perspective. This letter A, man's perspective under the sun. Think about that. A perspective for man, a proper perspective for man under the sun. In verse 9, he asks this question, what does the worker gain from all his toil? Now, he asked that similar question in chapter 1. He says, is all this labor really worth it? Well, in light of this new evidence, Solomon gives a resounding yes, it is. If we have the right perspective, and he lays out a proper perspective. First of all, number one, we must see a life as a gift from God. You've got to see it as a gift from God. In verse 10, he says, I've seen the burden God has laid on men. I like the New King James translation there. Let me read it. I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. Another translation translates that God-given task as a business. I've seen the business that we're supposed to be in. It is a task. It is work. But as bad as it may seem sometimes, it is God-given. It may seem like a strange gift. And if we look at it in a positive perspective, it's a blessing. Everything we have is a blessing, a gift from God, and we thank Him for it. And we have that positive attitude toward difficulties. But if we look at it from a negative perspective, then it becomes a burden, toilsome, drudgery. There's that little axiom that says, outlook determines the outcome. And whatever your outlook is helps mold and shape the outcome of what you're going through. A second above the sun perspective is to seek beauty in the midst of the ugly. He says that in the following phrase, He has made everything beautiful in His time. So we seek the beauty. We seek the best in the midst of the rough and the tough and the ugly. You look for it. And let me clarify, the Hebrew translation of this word beautiful, it does translate beautiful sometimes, but other times it translates fair, well. So don't get the idea of beauty and pretty in your mind when you see this idea, He makes everything beautiful in His time. The idea is that in the appropriate time, He does the appropriate thing. And no matter what it is, when we're past it, we can look back and say, it is well. Remember that song? It is well. As we look back and trust His sovereignty, we know that His love for us is great, His arm for us is mighty, and His works for us are good, and we can trust him in his sovereignty. For example, why in the world would Jesus say, love your enemies? I mean, why in the world do we even have to have enemies, God? But he tells us, love your enemies. You know, there's something an enemy would do for you that a friend cannot. Sometimes those enemies and those detractors will drive you to God's word more than you've ever been before. They'll push you into your knees in prayer more than you've ever been there before. They'll force you to depend on the family of God and the support from the church more than you've ever been before. So Jesus said, love them. Bless them. Man, when they come ask you for fire for their oven over in their house, don't just give them a little coal. Put a bunch of coals. They would carry them in a little bonnet on top of their head. Just heap their heads full of coals. Bless them. And we want things to be smooth and pleasant in our lives, but that would put us in charge. And we're not in charge, folks. God is on his throne. We don't want the hurt and pain, but God will allow that to take place in our lives so that we can see things from a bigger, better point of view. And number three, another proper perspective is to take into account this sense that we have in our hearts, this sense that we're linked to eternity, this sense that I know there's something greater out there, this sense that I have deep in my heart that God has placed here. It says he has placed eternity in the hearts of men. St. Augustine, this great phrase, he said, thou hast made us for thyself, and our hearts are restless until they learn to rest in thee. Man is different from the animal. We long to see the face of God. We know that there's something out there. And you combine this phrase, him having said eternity in the hearts of men, with this next phrase from verse 11. It brings us to the fourth element of an under the sun, above the sun perspective. Yet they cannot fathom what God has done from beginning to end. They cannot fathom what God has done. Fathom, it's that word they use in nautical terms to sound the depths. We cannot understand what God has done. And we'll never find, I mean, Solomon couldn't find total satisfaction. And God accomplishes his purpose, but we don't understand it in our time, but in his time. When we enter into eternity and look back, then it will start making sense. So many of the things we wonder about will start making sense. C.S. Lewis, a great author and Christian, wrote this phrase, our Heavenly Father has provided many delightful ends for us along our journey, but he takes great care to see that we do not mistake any of them for home. There is a longing in our hearts for what David called, the old King David, that long home he talked about, that eternal dwelling. There is a yearning and there is an itch that we can't scratch under the sun that one day we will be able to be satisfied. And this fifth thought, a proper perspective, kind of swings us into another trend, but let me say this word, celebrate. Celebrate. One of the great perspectives that we're motivated above the sun by is the idea of celebrating life in the now. Not living in the past, but celebrating now. He says in verses 12 and 13, there's nothing better for a man than to be happy and to do good while they live, that everyone may eat and drink and find satisfaction. Now, Koheleth is not encouraging pagan hedonism in any sense of the term. But he's encouraging the practice of enjoying God's gifts in the now. And let me hasten to say, I know we've got some folks in here that aren't wealthy. But wealth is not how much you have, but how much you enjoy what you do have. Would you hold on to that thought? It's not how big a thing you got or how many of them you have, but what you do to enjoy and be satisfied with what you do have. That's what Solomon is saying here. Child of God, our life is an adventure. It's a pilgrimage, discovering his eternal plan. On the other hand, that one that has not begun that adventure, that one that does not grab this perspective and understand this perspective over the sun, that person's life is a maze of monotony and frustration and discouragement. It's like the old Puritan minister Thomas Watson said, "Eternity to a godly man is a day that has no sunset. But eternity to the wicked is like a night that has no sunrise." Letter B. This is a swing point in the passage, verses 12 and following. Letter B gives us some purposes, God's purposes, for this remarkable plan of above the sun living. It's a recipe, so to speak, some application that we should apply to our lives from above the sun perspective, not under the sun where we don't see it all, but he gives us a glimpse into God's plan. First, he said there, we just read it, enjoy life. Let me read it from the Holman Christian Standard Bible. That's a relatively new translation that the Baptist denomination made happen. Some people teasingly say the HCSB stands for a hardcore Southern Baptist, but that's not true. Multiple groups worked on that, but really used the texts that were as good as they could find. And I like the way they translate the second part of this verse. There's nothing better for men than to rejoice and enjoy the good life. And there are things in life to enjoy and to rejoice, to grab for all the gusto and seize the day. Solomon, the searcher, says, "That's all right. Okay, go for it. Grab it." And then number two, he says, be satisfied with your life. Verse 13, he says, that everyone may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all his toil. This is the gift of God. I love that verse. Be satisfied. Underline, if you, not in my pew Bible, please, but if you got your own Bible, underline that phrase right there. Be satisfied. Find satisfaction. Find satisfaction. It's not something that I can produce, but as we get involved with what God is involved in, the stuff we go through day to day, we might have momentary, but not lasting pleasure. But when we think something is going to really satisfy, we become like the old Koheleth, that vanity, vanity, nothing satisfies, meaningless, meaningless. The secret here is finding His plan for that thing that you want to enjoy, His plan for those activities you want to be involved in, not just the self-centered, myopic perspective, but that thing in relationship to God, that stuff you own, those responsibilities you have. True satisfaction is a gift from God as long as we are putting Him in the picture and involving Him in the process, not just getting more and more, but being satisfied with what we have and seeing where He is in the mix. And that leads us to number three, which is powerful. In verse 14, we see that we should cultivate an awe-filled, I like the word awesome or awe-full, an awe-filled reverence. Put that word down for God. It's right here in the verse. I know that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it or anything taken away from it. God has made it so. This is where our faith comes in. This is where the faith life kicks in. Koheleth, Solomon, discovered that God is in charge and He won't let anyone bend His plan. I cannot thwart and change God's plan. So I trust in His sovereignty and I relax in that trust. But that's where the biggest struggle comes in for us, isn't it? We want to play God sometimes. We want to be in charge. And my goodness, what happens to us when we are? And sometimes when Christians don't get their way, I'm sorry to say, even Christians, for those of you all that are just here searching, checking it out, just studying this issue, I'm sorry, but even Christians at times don't get their way and they get mad and angry at God and go off and sulk and decide they'd go play some other game. And we throw away our faith and we walk away and we just think, what's the use? I tried it, it doesn't work. What a foolish question. What a foolish statement. God will not surrender his prerogatives. This same verse translated in the New King James says, God has made it so in order that men should fear before him. You ever heard that phrase, the fear of the Lord? Time and time again, that phrase comes up in the Bible, the fear of the Lord. Solomon said, I don't know if it was before or after his experience of Ecclesiastes, we just don't know, but he says in the very first chapter of the Proverbs, he says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. His father David said it in the Psalms. And so as we surrender to him, as we trust and we revere him, we fear. It's not an idea of being afraid. It's a holy respect, an awesome reverence before him. And we trust him and know that he is in charge. And we rest in that. And we don't know the answers to the whys and the whats and the whens and the hows. We don't know the things. Those questions are there and will always be there. But we trust in his great wisdom, and we get closer to that wisdom as we reverence him and respect him and are awed in front of him. That's why worship is so important, dear friend. Sometimes what we do in here is not so much worship, but as we think of the magnitude and the magnificence and the awesomeness of God, we don't have to have a song to do it. That helps. We don't have to have a preacher to do it. That helps. But just to come into his presence and be awed and stilled before him, to reverence and worship him. And lastly, Solomon looks ahead, and he sees the certainty of death. Just put the word ahead there. Look ahead. Death is coming. I'm going to pick that up next week because there's just been so much that I wanted to share in this part. But look ahead. Death is coming. And we'll study that a lot. Don't miss next week. It's going to be good. But as we come to a conclusion here, as we don't understand it all, you've seen a loom and a weaver sitting at a loom making some tapestry or some cloth. Here's a picture of one. And the cloth is interlaced and woven, and there's the spinning, there's the pressing. But you know, if you look at the product before it's finished. If you looked at the backside of that loom or that weaver's beam, as you look at the backside, you see a lot of knotty, undone threads that aren't pretty. They're just hanging there. It's an ugly scene. Just as when we look at life from under the sun, as Solomon has been saying, it just doesn't make sense. But the weaver is at work. The artisan is making a design. We're told in the book of Ephesians that we are his poetry. We are his workmanship. And he's not finished with us yet. So don't stop, even though you see some ugly knots and some tattered threads hanging there. Because, dear friend, when the product is done, when we're on the other side, there is a pattern that he has been at work on in your life. There is a beautiful picture that he has been working on for you, to make you his poetry, his workmanship, to use you wherever you are. But you've got to seize the day. I put those notes in your conclusion. You've got to seize the day. You've got to live in the now. I think it was Descartes that challenged us not to live in the past, not to live in the future, but to live in the now, as one of those early philosophers. Seize the day, live in the now. You see, the past is nothing but a canceled check. The future is just a promissory note. But today, it's money in the hand, and it's all we have. Seize the day. Last week, I gave you a couple of takeaways. I reminded you that there are only two things that last forever, God's Word and people. I told you, get in God's Word and let God's Word get into you and then let that get into people. Today, I want to give you another thought along that same line. There are really only two things that go on into eternity. People and memories. People and memories. All you have is now. So make some good friends and make some great memories. I think that's what church, not a building, not an activity, but a family people. That's what we ought to be about as much as we can, making good friends and making some great memories. Would you pray with me for a moment? Doubtlessly, there would be someone here that's never become part of the family of faith. We would love to share with you how that could be done. This has been a message mostly to Christians, but I wouldn't want to close the service without telling someone that may have tried Christianity. Someone told you that it was going to give you joy and happiness, and my goodness, then something tragic happened in your life, and you said, well, I sure don't need any of that stuff. So you've turned your back. You've walked away like those that I spoke about in the sermon. But that's not Christianity, friend. Christianity is a personal, vital, deep relationship with God, and it begins as I surrender and I ask Him to take control of my life. And I may not like the bumps in the road, but I know that He's not finished with me yet. And He has a plan for my life. And He is actively engaged in making that plan come together in that beautiful tapestry of life. You may be struggling with some decision. You may be struggling with some of the tragedies through which you've gone. Koheleth, Solomon, he said, He will make all things beautiful in His time. He will work it out. It may not be the time right now, but don't just leave the game because it's not the right time. Don't check out. Don't go away. But sign up. Sign up for duty. Sign up to get engaged in using those gifts and talents and things that He has given you, and find God in all the mix of it. And let Him use you. In this time, in the now, let Him use you. Don't be waiting for that dream job, that dream mate, that dream opportunity. Don't. You got the now. That's all you got. You got the now. Grab it and use it. If you've never come to Jesus, oh, friend, do it now. Do it now. Come to Jesus. Give Him your life. As naughty and ragged as it might look, like the backside of a tapestry, just give it to Him and trust Him. Trust Him that in His time, He will make all things beautiful. Even you, even me. He'll use us, and together, He'll use us for the better. Lord Jesus, as we come to this time, I just pray that You'd give us a sense and an awe of Your sovereignty, of Your bigness, of Your greatness. That we would be smitten, struck with how great a God we serve and how great a God You are to let us know You a little bit, to trust You a lot, and to walk with You a long way. Bless this time of invitation. With our heads bowed and eyes closed, this is a time that if you have a struggle, a need, come and pray. There will be some people down here that will just kneel down and pray with you, or sit here on a bench with you and pray. If you'd like to come to know Jesus and give your life to Him, you come. One of us will share. If we don't have time right now, we'll stay around this afternoon and share a little while. If you've never followed Him in believer's baptism and you'd like to identify, that's the New Testament way of identifying with Jesus is following Him in baptism, immersion, showing the world I'm on Jesus' side. I'm living for Jesus. You come and we'll tell you how we can make that happen. Or just as we've told so many, we need some partners. We need some folks to help us here. Laborers in the harvest. You'd like to move your membership from a sister church or even another denomination. We can talk with you about that. You come and share that with us. We'll be glad to talk with you about that. But during these moments, you come, you pray, you sit in prayer, stand and sing, and make that decision. Just share with one of us if you need to.